The modern university is facing something of an identity crisis. A little of this may simply have to do with growing pains. Universities have changed a great deal since the days when just a few monks would lock themselves away to look at plants and copy ancient texts by hand. The university's role as creator and guardian of the knowledge of the public domain is changing radically with the times. Today's university is seeing higher enrollment than ever before, even as tuition costs skyrocket. Now, there's no subject under the sun that can't be canonized, analyzed, lectured on, or otherwise jammed through an academic lens. And there's a greater diversity of options for higher education as well. Nonprofit, for-profit, small private colleges, land-grant universities, community colleges, and even a few universities on the web. Today's guest suggests there are also a few other forces at work here. Other actors that are forcing our universities to do a little bit of soul-searching about their role in society. The biggest among them being the web itself, which has made the flow of information so fast, cheap, and easy. The role of the modern university, at once dedicated to the ideal of open exchange of ideas and information, and at the same time coping with the reality of a system of markets and governments that put protections around the use of intellectual property, was the subject of intense discussion at a major conference earlier this summer in Italy. Charles Nessen was a distinguished participant in this discussion. He joined David Weinberger this week to share some clips from that event and to suggest some ways the university could embrace a new role in the networked world.
The Communia Conference is set up by an organization in a nonprofit organization devoted to the public domain in Italy called Nexa, as an agent of the European Union. They actually ran a project over a three-year period of gathering people in conferences from the common market countries together to talk about issues relating to the public domain.
What exactly is the public domain? Maybe we should look first at something that you said there, explaining exactly what the public domain is.
I think of the public domain from a student's point of view. Somebody coming onto the net, and the public domain is everything that someone coming onto the net can access for free without feeling at risk that they're going to be sued. So it's actually the free space of the net that is open as a common wealth of all citizens of the net.
Well, I took the position there, I take the position that the public domain is really the commonwealth of bits that is accessible to someone on the net for free. That is, thinking from a child's point of view or a user's point of view who doesn't have a credit card, what is it that you can reach on the net for free without risk of being sued? If I asked you to define the public domain legally, you would struggle and you'd wind up doing it in the negative. It's that which is not somehow subject to the laws of what, our jurisdiction, some other jurisdiction, completely unclear what the public domain is as an affirmative definition, unless you put it in the operational terms in which a digital citizen would relate to it. That is, can I get access to it? Do I have to pay for it? Am I at risk if I access this that someone will sue me?
But since we can't control who's going to sue you, wouldn't a good, well-publicized lawsuit, even if it's out of left field, makes no sense, scare people enough that lawsuit itself now has shrunk the public domain?
Tell me about it. That's exactly.
Have you ever heard of such a thing happening, for example?
Yes, exactly. Well, two examples that are very current. One is the case of the innocent infringer, the person who's sufficiently young and unsophisticated that they have no real conception of copyright, no notice of actual copyright, and they're not sure exactly what it is. Think about file sharing as simply using the internet the way one would use the radio. that person now is subjected to immense statutory penalty with no concern whatsoever for the innocence of their state of mind, even on the question of mitigation of damages. That's one. The second one is this remarkable explosion now that is promised by the Righthaven litigation, which is someone buying up the copyrights of a newspaper with respect to given articles which have been cited and reproduced by bloggers who discuss things, and then bringing these statutory damage actions en masse against the people who blogged. So the end result they're shooting for is that copyright infringement will henceforth be merely the copying of copyrighted bits. Completely the innocence, the state of mind of the person who does the copying, completely irrelevant. And that's a very extreme view of what kind of freedom one has on the net. And when you extrapolate that to the problem of the blogger who's now going to cite the newspaper article or use it in some way, the basic response is, whoa, wait a second, how do I know? And many of these people who are included are indeed innocent. They took it from an RSS feed. There's no copyright notice on digital files, and so it's at a point where, yes, absolutely, if one scales forward on the law, the way the copyright industry has succeeded in getting the courts to craft it, if one scales forward in time, it looks bleak for the idea that one would download bits, copy bits, share files, without presuming that they're copyrighted and having the burden of somehow proving that they're part of the public domain before you download.
If you're just joining the conversation, David Weinberger is speaking with Charles Nessen of the Berkman Center. Nessen just returned from the Communia Conference on University and Cyberspace, where dozens of scholars gathered to talk about the role of academia in relation to the web. Juan Carlos de Martin of the Nexus Center for Internet and Society spoke at the conference on how the internet is changing the roles of creators and consumers.
So many times when we discuss about content online, there is this idea that the only or the most important use is just consuming. And therefore, all these metaphors of piracy, of stealing, and there is so little emphasis on the fact that you can actually do things with the things that you find online. You can actually have entrepreneurial ideas, so you can recreate and remix existing ideas in order to make your point. So in my view, a lack of emphasis on what you can actually do, not simply consume.
And of course, what people do when they download bits is not always simply listen to them. This is part of an active culture of use and reuse.
Yes, but I think that Juan Carlos there is actually talking about the two-way nature of access to the public domain. One can think of access to the public domain from the user's point of view of access to the bits, but one can also think of access to the public domain from the creator's point of view. The creator who wants to create in a way that contributes to the public domain. And when you look and see how many impediments there are in the way of doing that, it's quite extraordinary.
You would think that the universities would be all about the public domain, given their mission. But Terry Fisher actually talked at the conference a bit about a movement in the other direction.
2003, Derek Bach, not so recently retired as president of Harvard, wrote a very interesting book, Universities in the Marketplace, in which he described and for the most part lamented the increasing engagement of universities in profit-making. First, universities, especially in the United States, were increasingly seeking through participation in athletics to make money, to recruit athletes who couldn't participate as students on an equal level with their peers, and to build large stadiums, enter into television contracts, and so forth, all in order to earn money. Second trend is more relevant to our topic here. Universities were increasingly, circa 2000, asserting and then exercising intellectual property rights over the fruits of their research.
Well, you know, that's a little distressing.
Yes, and this conference was, this culminating Communia conference, was about the mission and method of university looking forward to cyberspace. In a sense, it was the development thesis of this conference that the internet is under threat from governments through security surveillance and under threat from commerce, from copyright and other forms of filtering. And neither of those are institutions in favor of openness. They're into constraint and making profit from it. The response is, yes, the pressure of the profit-making from university intellectual property and so forth has been a distortion and in some way a distraction away from what the public mission is of the university. And if universities can be brought to a reassertion of that mission through recognition of how central it is actually to what it means to be a university and what it will mean to be a university in cyberspace, then the internet actually will find a kind of three-legged base with government, commerce, and university.
The collaborative nature of much of what goes on the net must make questions of ownership and copyright far more complex. And Urs Gasser actually talked a bit about that.
Of course, much of the content that is created in a peer situation, right? Quite often you would have friends reading, reviewing, clicking on the things you created, be it even on a Facebook status update. And I think there are important skills, as research indicates, associated with that type of creativity. So it's not only to be creative in the first place and produce something new, but it's actually learning also quite a bit in terms of social skills, in terms of information literacy and media literacy. And this may actually be something new as opposed to Ananda, my daughter, sitting at the table drawing a nice house, right? Because it's deeply embedded in a social context.
So given the sort of impossibly and sometimes inadvertently collaborative nature of what we're producing together because of the messiness of all these social networks, how do we ever possibly handle all of the IP issues, the copyright issues? I mean, who owns a conversation between two people on Facebook?
What I heard in Urs's comment was something that had to do with the methodology of universities. To what extent need universities change their orientation to their student body, given the changes in the way students learn? And further, to what extent, in thinking about the architecture of universities, do we need to think in terms of the architectures of digitally assisted spaces, so that some spaces have no tech in them? It's just teacher to student in an isolated environment, and yet other environments in which the students are learning these new social skills are so filled with the multiplicity of sources that the very management of that becomes part of growing up in the society. As to the issues of collaborative copyright and who makes claims, we've moved into a space in which the making of the claim and the backing of it with the willingness to sue overrides the merits of the claim. We're in a situation where if I sue you for copyright violation, and I'm a corporate copyright holder or I'm in the business of doing this, I can make the process sufficiently uncomfortable and expensive for you so that you will settle the lawsuit independent of merits.
Are we seeing yet in the university and in practice in the universities the new set of social skills that the new generation is learning just by growing up on the net? Are we seeing those skills manifest themselves in how students are learning or how they're being taught?
Yes, I think so. I'm not sure. Oh, I would say definitely. I'm not sure it's systematic. And I am sure that it's not coming down from the top as much as it's bubbling up. But, for example, it's now possible to do surveys on the net very easily. Suddenly, papers are full of data that are generated by students who are doing surveys. So there's a tool that's available, and the kids see how to bring it to bear on the problem, and okay, here it is. I feel like there's negative learning going on. I think that for myself, there was a process of experimenting with classrooms in which everybody's got their laptop on and everything is live, and finding that there were serious negatives to that, and wanting to architect my classroom so that sometimes they're empty of tech, sometimes they're full of tech, but not just homogeneous, whatever it happens to be. I want to be the architect of the rhetorical environment in which the learning takes place. And I think that's bound to be an approach that radiates throughout the university.
It is what every website owner does who allows any form of interactivity. You decide what form of interactivity you're going to have with your readers. Is it going to be comments, moderated comments, threaded comments, reputation system? Are you going to have a policy about what sorts of language you can use and all the rest of it? So in the online world, it's completely taken for granted that the person who put up the space architects it. In classrooms and in the real world, it's not yet always acknowledged that that's the case.
And in fact, one of the really key points at this conference was this is an integrated environment. John Palfrey very powerfully speaks as a librarian to the fact that the new library is not the virtual library, the real library. It's the library. And he expresses just what you're saying.
We haven't done the design work of trying to think about what does a university or a classroom or a library or a dorm, the constituent parts, what does it look like if it's a hybrid learning environment? A learning environment in the sense that sometimes in a library, someone walks in to request a book and you get it off the shelf and you go read it within the classical confines of a beautiful room. But at least half of the time, the student comes in your virtual front door. At least half of the time, the student comes to your website to find the information. And actually, most of the time, they don't come to you first. Most of the time, we know from our data, they go to Google first. And they look for something there, and they go to Wikipedia, they go to Amazon and elsewhere. If they come back to your website, you're lucky. That's the environment in which they're learning. And I think that hybrid environment is what we have to design for.
So as we try to rethink in the way that John Palfrey is suggesting, should we be looking to conform these spaces to the habits of thought that the new generation is entering with, or should we be maintaining more of the old values, or more generally, how does this conform with the university's mission? How do we go from the university's mission to figuring out what the right way of constructing these spaces are?
here's what I think. The most profound idea that I have about architecture is summed up in the idea that if you want to know where to lay down the bricks for the path, you just plant grass and then put the bricks where the grass gets worn out by the footprints. So the challenge, in a sense, for architecture, and I think this is as true with university as anywhere else, is to be flexible. Basically, the architect is working in very heavy materials, the foundations and cement and steel and so forth, and yet their goal is to be flexible in the use so that it suits not only the use at the moment it was built, but suits somehow the use over the time of its existence. And it's obviously very challenging and somehow subject to influence by the way spaces get used. It's not proven a completely easy thing to take classrooms, which are remarkably rigid places with seats that are screwed into the ground and lecterns that you worry about people carrying away and so forth. They've not been the easiest spaces to architect in flexible terms. And it's definitely true that something that looks right for the today can tomorrow look quite silly. Things are moving very fast. But beyond that, I think it's as much a willingness to be sensitive to it as you're going along, and at the same time not try to be too hip.
In terms of digital architectures, obviously far, far more flexible, there is this sort of general question that gets raised in various forums all the time, where, I'll put this very crudely, but the old values look at the new values of what the kids do, and the old values say, well, they're doing it all wrong, we need to do what we've always done, which is to break their spirit and get them to live by our values. And then there's the new values who say, well, no, we need to move on. This is a very difficult transition period for us, where it's clear, you can almost identify the people embodying the values. How does a university deal with this contest?
For the most part, universities function as a place where parents can send their kids to get them out of the house. It's where the kids get away from the parents. It's where they live in an environment where they learn to adjust to a different kind of authority structure and different sets of relations. So what emerged powerfully out of the conference was, in many ways, it's the social, intellectual learning environment of the university, which remains at its core, no matter whether the kids have computers or they don't have computers. Now, that says something about the totally digital university that has no center and somehow is totally abstracted. It does. It says that's not the same experience that we have learned to value in having our kids, as they leave adolescence and reach adulthood, spend a bunch of time in a place that allows them to socialize in a fashion that seems to have had a tremendous value over the years. And I don't think it's sensible for universities to fail to realize that, and at the same time to recognize that when you've brought that social group together, it's an essential feature of the university experience to teach contribution to the public domain as part of what it means to be a citizen of the modern world, really, the modern digital world.
If you're just joining the conversation, David Weinberger is speaking with Charles Nessen of the Berkman Center. Nessen just returned from the Communia Conference on University and Cyberspace, where dozens of scholars gathered to talk about the role of academia in relation to the web. There's a lot to talk about when you think of universities as creators and archivers of knowledge, so it's easy to forget about the education part. David asked Charlie for his thoughts on the educational role of universities.
There's one piece that's missing in this consideration of what the university is. And I personally really love the second part of it. And I'm fascinated to see the model of learning itself become taken not as simply a enhancement of the private life, but as something that is done in public and can be done for the public at the same time as one's learning. Nevertheless, the missing piece, and I think anybody listening to this will say, what happened to the education part? So we have universities as a place where children go to grow up. But, you know, you could do that in the Army. You could do that at a summer camp. You could do that by getting a job and joining, moving to a place that has some sense of community. And the part that is missing between universities as a place for students to go and a place where learning gives back or does something for the public is the sense of education, of knowledge, of that which has traditionally made the university distinct among the places where we send our children to grow up. So where's that core in this?
To me, that core comes in the commitment of university and faculty to an orientation that is not centered on money. It's the obverse of what Derek Bach's message is. Derek is saying, don't let the university get traduced by all the money. It's the other side of that saying, hang on to what it is that makes us a place that's great for children to grow up in. And that involves a commitment to principle, to intellectual discourse, to reason, to fairness, to learning as an enjoyable experience, both in the form of absorption and expression. So those values are necessary for so many other facets of the society, but to somehow organize a university as if it's just a for-profit organization, or if it's just a kind of a transmit-the-information organization, I think misses the ultimate and central core of the ideal of education, which I want the universities to embody.
So only a few years ago, the more or less common wisdom, the accepted answer to the question, what is a university, would inevitably have included the notion that it is a preservation of culture, values, and learning, something like that, that there's some core set. You go to college because you're going to read Shakespeare there, and if you don't go to college, you're not going to read Shakespeare. And if you don't read Shakespeare, and if a generation loses Shakespeare, then our culture has failed in its job of taking what's best in that notion, which gets expressed in its worst form perhaps as a canon, is completely missing from how you've described a university. You have a commitment to learning and so forth, but not to a body of learning.
Well, in my mind, if one sees cyberspace as an environment that doesn't exist until you build it, so this reservoir of knowledge bits is small at the beginning, and it would be great to see it enhanced. All right. The engines of enhancement are clearly the universities. I mean, we've seen commerce and so forth, but if one were to see the strength of universities turn towards the enhancement of the reservoir of knowledge bits, you can see that you would be starting a mighty engine. All right, then the question becomes, well, all right, what bits does each university somehow focus on the contribution side? Well, it naturally follows, at least in my mind, that what you would be wanting to express in the sense of having a responsibility for seeing it represented in the future of knowledge space would be your own cultural heritage, the heritage of your university that you somehow more and better express than anyone else. And if that were to be seen as an enterprise that is itself a very educational enterprise for the students at that university, so that doing that was part of the educational process, then you have the feeling of the elements of the puzzle filling in ways that simply don't have everything overlapping and a solid space being built.
So you would have colleges contributing that which is unique to them, resulting in an aggregate of that which is in common to all.
Yes.
Stuart Schieber at the conference talked a bit about what academics bring to this mix.
I'll mention three things. Of course, there are many things that motivate academics to do what they do, but I'll mention three things that certainly motivate academics. First of all, certainly curiosity is one. Curiosity, which leads to an insatiable urge to learn and discover. Curiosity is often the thing that leads people to become academics in the first place. Second of all, what motivates academics is vanity. Curiosity without vanity leads to a kind of monastic scholarship of the sort that we saw in the early history of the university that Charles Nesson alluded to. But vanity leads academics to actually want to distribute their knowledge to their own credit, and also, as it happens, to the greater knowledge of society. And the third, which I won't talk about at the moment, but I'll come back to later, is laziness. So curiosity, vanity, and laziness.
What's the laziness of academics?
Well, Stuart is talking about the action item of this conference, which is actually making the work product of faculties open access, part of the public domain. And he's addressing the problem that under the existing structure, there are impediments in the way of that happening. And that faculty, even though they're not in it for the money really, they're curious types, and they want their work widely distributed so they would love the public to absorb it, are lazy and unwilling, unless it's made easy and clear, to take the steps to actually exercise the control that American faculty members have to make their work public. It's one of the, in a sense, blessings of the university world that individual faculty members have the copyright in their work. It's not considered to be work for hire of the university. But in the process of having that copyright, the actual process of using it in a way that opens their work to access does take a little effort. And Stuart is leading not only the effort here at Harvard, which has now been adopted by 5 of the Harvard schools, but an effort at schools, universities around the country, where faculty are seeing the benefit of following the open access approach that Stuart advocates. It's been unanimous on the faculties here, I believe, which have adopted it. But again, the actual institutional process of getting consideration and adoption of the necessary resolution through the faculties and the general counsel's office, that takes some energy. It would be great if somehow we could touch into a wellspring of energy that would move universities towards doing what I believe is clearly the right thing for universities to do and follow Stuart's lead.
And yet there's a countervailing economics, so to speak. Academics are often tempted to publish in high prestige journal that traditionally have required copyright assignment. And that is so tempting because it's where prestige has been, it's where tenure decisions have been based upon that sort of thing. So it can't simply be laziness. There's also a sort of institutional structure that works against opening this stuff up.
And I must say a key to Stuart's approach is to completely respect that instinct of any faculty member, so that the faculty member who wants to write for profit has merely to say that that's what I want to do, and it's your right. But it sets the default unless the faculty member acts to open access. That's the key.
John Palfrey at the conference raised the question of the university as an authority, as the grantor of credentials. Back when the university was clearly about helping students master a body of knowledge and getting a credential that attested to that, it was much simpler. Do universities still have that sort of authority? Should they? Should we be looking elsewhere? Is that sort of authority just not with us anymore?
Oh, I think the credentialing authority continues, and the function continues. It says, basically, a student has come and gone through a program and spent time doing it and completed it satisfactorily. The credentialing, though, that I hear Palfrey worried about is the kind of fear that's expressed with students using Wikipedia, and is this reliable information since it was compiled by who knows who? And that, to me, is a wonderful thing to be explored, and seems to me completely consistent with the other form of credentialing that universities do. So, for example, if you're studying history, a good university doesn't credential a history. It leads the student to understand that the historian who writes the history that the student reads is writing it in a context in which the meaning of it needs to be understood. So not to be taken as gospel because you read the words of text, but because you understand its origin and the elements that framed it. That's been the university's function with respect to information of many different kinds, understanding information in its context and teaching both. So to me, that's a challenge, absolutely, and especially a challenge for older people who are less familiar with these sources which are being questioned than the younger people to whom the idea of credentialing is being communicated.
And that's actually completely in line with at least how I understand Wikipedia's ethos of it's bad form to argue for your position at Wikipedia by claiming a credential. Well, I'm the senior professor of history at wherever.
Yes, right.
Because that's a claim of content expertise when, in fact, the actual credential should emerge in the discussion itself.
Yes.
In fact, you at the conference, in the final session, talked about the deep interrelationship between, well, I'll say the mission of the university and the mission, so to speak, of the Internet itself.
From the beginning, it's struck me that Internet as a free space, a freely connected space, was at once a kind of perhaps a last chance for humanity at human connection. Maybe not, maybe that's too grand. But at the same time, a very delicate space, a space that was created by university, and yet the people, the forces that came to see it as a tremendously generative space, turned out predominantly, at least so far, to be the forces of commerce and corporatism, and now the forces of security. And so my worry from the beginning was that the Internet had no grounding institutionally in the power institutions of the world that would maintain it as an architecture that was open, with a philosophy that was open, against the forces of corporatism on the one hand and of government security on the other. And so my thought coming in was an instrumental thought. University struck me as a base, potentially, a set of institutions in the world that have a set of commitments that are most internet-friendly in the sense of the free space of the internet.
How hopeful are you that universities will step up to this challenge?
I'm an optimist, but everybody tells me that. So I'm in this position of when I'm trying to think creatively and constructively about the future, I think it's possible. And so I imagine how could universities, which, I mean, there are 10,000 universities in the world. There's no email list for universities. There's no organization of universities. They're disparate, independent, functioning organizations. How could the idea, the meme of public interest, public service, public expression relating to cultural heritage get expressed within a university world at a level where those who are strategically thinking about the future of their universities would actually hear it and listen to it? That is, there must be at this point in every university someone who's thinking about what will the future of this university be? What should its mission be? And if we could just figure out, if I could figure out how to make the message clear enough and interesting enough so that somehow they would hear it. I would hold the hope that there might be motion in that direction. Now, the pessimist in me worries that it's that the forces on the other side are huge. The forces of commerce. I've myself been contesting with the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA. The forces of the copyright giant are huge in the intellectual property area. The position of the consumer, the user, is overwhelmed. And on the government side, they've actually captured the word cyberspace now. One of the interesting things about this conference was the actual exploration of the origin of the word with Gibson in Neuromancer, and how it's been treated and how it's now been captured as a security vehicle by the cybernauts who are protecting us. So I don't know. I mean, it's a future that that has promise. I'm hopeful, but at the same time, I'm doubtful.
And yet, universities as the open space in the course of a life where people, the young in particular, are able to come to themselves and explore who they are, free of the pressures of commerce, free of, to a large extent, the pressures of government. The university as a social space, an educational space, independent of the internet, does seem to make it to be not just the last bastion, but the ideal bastion for the reclaiming of the internet space.
Yes, I think that's right. That is, if you are looking to youth in some respect, if you're looking to the digital native generation to somehow grow up and assert its freedom, you would expect it to take place within a university environment first and grow from there out to beyond. And I think you see some strong evidence of it. People are in many ways shocked by the changes in norms of privacy from older people to younger people. Well, reverse that. That's change that's coming up from the bottom. And one of the ways of seeing a lot of what law does is law acts to reassure older people against the change that, let's face it, it's coming, but at least you can go to law and shout and try and do something about it and express yourself in that way. If somehow the idea of university contribution to the digital domain in the form of expression, articulation, preservation of the university's zones of study, if that could become seen as something sensible for universities to students, so that it became a student idea of what a university should be doing, that's got the possibility of connection and spreading. I would love to see it not as a radical movement, but as a completely constructive movement that actually enhances university values rather than somehow seeks to obstruct them. I'd want Derek Bach to be proud.
Thank you very much.
Charles Nesson is a founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and the William F. Weld Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. What did you think about today's show? Do you think that universities could be playing a more active role in cyberspace? Tell us at the comments page for today's show at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. You can also find out a lot more about this topic, including a YouTube playlist of videos we put together just for today's episode. Thanks go out to the organizers of the Communia Conference who brought us today's clips, too numerous to mention, the Nexus Center for Internet and Society, Juan Carlos de Martin, Stuart Schieber, Urs Gasser, John Palfrey, and of course Charles Nessen, as well as Amar Asher. Today's episode was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.